Hello and welcome to Light the Way with Dr. Colin Monger. He's the senior pastor of Shepherd of the Hills Church. At Light the Way, we believe the most powerful tool we possess when sharing our faith with others is the Word of God. It was the Apostle Paul that said, "Faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the Word of Christ." So as we open the Word together, it's our prayer that you'll not only receive what God has for you, but share what you learn with those you come in contact with. And now, here's Pastor Colin.
Would you open your Bibles to the book of Ephesians, chapter 6? I want to talk a little bit about what it means to have a faithful home. I was reading recently that one half of all the kids in America right now live in a single parent home. And of the half that live in a home with two parents, only 40% of those parents are actually married to one another. According to the CDC, one quarter of all kids have no father figure in their lives, and half of those live below the poverty line. One particular study revealed that out of 1,000 teenagers who were surveyed over the course of 24 hours, 42% said in a single day they never heard a single word of praise. 44% said they never heard, "I love you," in 24 hours. And 50% of all the teenagers surveyed said in 24 hours' time, there wasn't a single instance of physical affection, like hugs or kisses or any kind of touch at all. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, in the 1960s, fewer than 5% of all of children were born to single mothers. In 2018, that was more than 40% of all births were to a single mother. Studies show that when children grow up like that, they are more likely to develop drug habits, to drop out of school, and to become incarcerated both before and after the age of 18. It's pretty safe to say there is a crisis in the American family. And so what's the answer? Well, it's not more government programs. It's not more laws. It's not more money. All the research shows it's ineffective because it comes after the fact. We need something that hits before the curve. Because while there is something to be said for helping children who find themselves in these circumstances through no fault of their own, the studies also say that when kids grow up in homes where there's both parents, there's a shared faith, there's consistent expectations, there's regular family time, that those kids will do better in life overall. And so the fix is not at the federal level. This is not a federal problem. The fix is at the family level. This is a family problem, a faith problem. In the book of Joshua, it says, "For me and my household, we will serve the Lord." What does that mean? What does it mean to be a faithful home? Well, that's what we want to talk about this morning. But before we get into it, there's a couple of things I need to make very clear. What we're about to read can be very personal. I know many people have different family dynamics. None of this is meant to make anyone feel bad. And it's intentional because we need to read what the Bible says, which means, remember, this is the goal. This is the representation of a perfect family. Now, with that in mind, none of us is perfect. No family is perfect. No Christian family is perfect. No Christian parent is perfect. I can't remember my children's names half the time. No Christian parent or family or household is perfect. And so I don't want you to get down on yourself if you see something you struggle with, because it just means you're a person. We all struggle with stuff. The Apostle Paul struggled with stuff. He said, "Not that I am already perfect, but I press on to make it my own. I press toward the goal," he said. There's no family on earth that will live up to this standard perfectly. But if we don't know the goal, we have no direction. If we don't have a target to aim for, we can't aim for anything. The second thing we need to understand is that faithfulness in the home does not require all of these things be present. In other words, you don't have to be married to have a faithful home. You don't have to have children to have a faithful home. Jesus was not married and did not have children. The Apostle Paul was not married and likely did not have children. Thus, it is not imperative that all of these things be there in order to have a faithful home. That's not what this is saying. What it says is that if these things are there, then this is what they would look like. And so with that in mind, notice what the Apostle Paul says about the faithful home, beginning in verse 1 of chapter 6. He says, "Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right." If you're going to have a faithful home, you have to have harmony. If you're taking notes this morning, you might want to jot down the word home, because we're going to use that as we go through this passage. Much like we did last week, we're going to use the word home as an acronym. And H stands for harmony. And notice what Paul says here. He says, parents in the Lord. You know, those four little letters make so many assumptions in life, and all of them relate to a state of harmony within the home. One of the things Paul assumes by this statement is that the parents are present in the lives of the children. You know, that's something that's not always true today. I was very surprised to read that most of the kids in foster care right now are not there because their parents have died. They are not there because their parents are even in jail. Most of the kids in foster care in America today are there simply because the parents are not present. They weren't interested in the child, and so they surrendered this little person to the state. And as a result of that, this kid has grown up in the foster care system. It's hard to have a family without the parents. And so Paul assumes they're there. Obey your parents. They're present. Second, he assumes they're both there. Notice it says, your parents, plural word. Parenting is a two-person job. If you're a single parent, or you know a single parent, or maybe your parents were single parents, you know how hard that can be to be the single breadwinner and the single caregiver and the single grocery shopper, the single cook and the single bill payer and the single house cleaner, the single chauffeur, the single parent to talk to the teachers when something goes wrong, and the single one who fixes all the boo-boos and all the owies. To have all of that rest on one person is a lot. All the research that's been done on the subject shows that a stay-at-home mother will do the equivalent of two full-time jobs, and that assumes she has a partner. It's a hard thing to be a single parent. When I was young, my parents divorced. I was about 5. My brother was about 2 or 3 when they finally split up. I remember, before the divorce, all the screaming and all the fighting and all the things being thrown through the home, I remember glass breaking on the walls and keys going through doors and all kinds of things. And I'll tell you, when they finally came to us and said they were going to go in different directions, it was almost a sigh of relief because we knew the circumstance. But what that meant was my dad became a single parent because we were military. My mother was not. She had to move off base. We stayed with our father. I remember growing up, the day would usually begin by our dad coming in to wake us up for school. It was, of course, early, and he was already in uniform for the day because he was military, which means he had gotten up long before that to get himself ready, now getting up to get us ready, driving us to a school, which I can't remember how far away it was, but it felt like a good distance. It was a private Christian school, not because we were rich or because we were a believing home, but because the schools in Washington, D.C., where we were so bad, my dad wanted us to be in a different environment. Not only that, but the private school had after-school care. That became very important because he had to work till 5:30. School doesn't go that long. And so we'd get out of school, we'd go to the daycare, he'd pick us up, again in uniform, drive us home. He would talk to us about our day. I have a lot of memories sitting at the kitchen table in the townhome we lived in there on base, doing my homework as my dad stood in the kitchen making dinner, still in uniform from the day's work. We would eat dinner, he would check our homework, he would give us baths. We would go to bed, again, him still in his uniform. And then the next day would start all over again. It's a hard thing to be a single parent. It's not God's plan for the family. All through the Bible, it talks about two-parent homes. In Exodus chapter 20, it says to honor your father and your mother. And here Paul says in verse 2, honor your father and your mother. And in verse 1, obey your parents. It's a very difficult thing. And so Paul assumes the parents are present, that they're both there. He assumes they have the same faith. Notice what it says in verse 1. Obey your parents in the Lord. There's no comma after parents. This is one statement. Obey your parents in the Lord. He assumes a common faith. One of the most important things when it comes to harmony in a home is a shared faith. In 2 Corinthians 6, the apostle tells us, do not be unequally yoked with believers. One of the things we talk to couples all the time about when they're getting married is how important it is to share a faith. And I tell them, I don't care if the one who was here leaves and goes to church with the other one, or they both come here. I don't even care if they come here one week and go to the other one's church another week, or if they find a new church all by themselves, as long as they do it together. We actually have a policy that says we will not do a wedding if it will unequally yoke a couple, because it always leads to disharmony in the home. I firmly believe that one of the best gifts a parent can give their child is a family structure built on a relationship with Jesus Christ. Because if we can agree there, odds are we're going to agree elsewhere as well. You remember the story of the Philippian jailer, and he was in a jail cell. Paul was with Silas in a jail cell in Philippi, and he had a jailer who was responsible for keeping them there. Well, an earthquake comes, and it's so violent that it shakes open the door to the cell. And the jailer is just convinced that Paul and Silas have left. After all, they're political prisoners. They haven't really done anything wrong. And he's about to kill himself, because certainly when Caesar finds out that they lost the great Paul, that his life would be over. And so Paul and Silas cry out from the jail cell, "Don't hurt yourself, we're still here." And the man can't believe it. Nobody would have blamed Paul and Silas for running off, and yet they didn't. They hadn't done anything wrong to be there, and yet they didn't run away. They had every opportunity to escape, and yet they didn't. And he's so moved by their act of faithfulness. The Bible tells us he came to faith. And it tells us in Acts 16 that he was baptized at once, him and all his family. He set that as a standard in the home. Over the summer, we had a men's conference here, and we had a speaker by the name of Jack Kranz. He's a chaplain at the Pennsylvania State Police. One of the things he does down in Coatesville is he has a ministry where they go into the jails and they minister to the inmates, and he shared a little bit about his life. He's in ministry, but so was his father. He remembers growing up, and their home was sort of an open door hub for all the neighborhood kids to come in and go out of. And he never remembers having fewer than 10 or 12 kids around the table, just people who would kind of trickle in at dinner time because they knew that there was good dinner to be had at the Kranz house. And so they had all the kids, and they had the friends, and they were a community staple. He was talking about his grandfather's faith and his grandmother's faith, and how his grandmother prayed over him every single day. He said something I'll never forget. He said, even all these years later, at 70 years old, he believes that his grandmother prayed for him so many times, he's still cashing in on those prayers today. Parents might not realize it, but kids are watching. And they're learning, and they're paying attention. And they want to be like their parents. I remember being a small boy and watching my dad, and I was just in awe of the things he could do. He could fix stuff that I had broken, and I had no idea how he'd put it all back together. I remember watching him use a hammer, and with just two or three swings, he could sink a whole nail. And how much I just wanted to be able to swing the big hammer like Dad could. The little hammer I had didn't move a nail hardly at all, but his hammer, well, it worked in two swings. I remember how it was almost like magic. He could pull a splinter out of his hand and not even cry. I remember he ate all of his dinner all the time, and he would shave and all of these things. And I remember thinking, one day, I'll be doing that one day. Kids are watching. There was a University of Michigan study that showed kids are actually paying more attention than we think, and at a younger age. The study revealed that at just 14 months old, children will mimic their parents. Their behaviors, their mannerisms, their sounds, their facial expressions, it all starts coming through. Whatever they see, that's what they're going to do. There was another study done by Science Magazine, and it wanted to see if children would truly mimic what they saw an adult do. And so they took an adult with a group of kids, and they put them in one room, and they gave the adult an unopened breakfast cereal box, like Fruit Loops or Cheerios or something like that. And then as a tool, gave them a blue writing pen. And the assignment was, in front of all of these kids, to use this blue pen, without saying a word, to open the cereal box. Well, that's absurd. That's not how you do it. It won't work very well. That was the experiment. Wouldn't you know it, when that adult left, every one of those children tried to do it the exact same way. Dr. Mark Nielsen from the Queensland University of Australia said, children will copy everything they see an adult do, even if there are obvious reasons why the action is irrelevant. The point is, kids are watching their parents, and they're learning from their parents. They're imitating their parents. And if they see that faith is important to them, it will be important to the kids. If they see that reading the Bible is important, and that praying is important, and giving thanks is important, that will set a seed in their life that will grow and sprout and develop later on. Oh, and by the way, age does not seem to be a factor. Older children still learn from their parents, just as younger children do. And so we need harmony in a home. Second, we need obedience in a home. Notice what Paul says in verse 1. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother. This is the first commandment with a promise, that it may go well with you and that you may live long in the land. If one of the best things we can give a home is structure, one of the worst things we can give a home is no expectations. And that's because you all know, and I know, life is full of them. It's full of deadlines. It's full of things we have to do under a certain period of time. That boss doesn't care why you're late. He just wants the job done. The mortgage company, they don't care why the payment's late. They just want their money. If you're in college or you remember those days, that professor, he didn't care why you couldn't study. If it's wrong, you're still going to get that F. That's the reality of life. And by expecting our children to reach a certain level of behavior in the home, parents can equip them to succeed in the rest of life. That's why Paul says right here in verse 3, that it may go well with you and you live long in the land. Children will succeed in life if they're held to a standard. Life is a lot easier when you're not at odds with everyone, isn't it? When you get along with your boss, boy, work is better. When you can pay your bills, it's not as scary to go to the mailbox. When you study for that test, you're not as worried when the grades come out. If you want your kids to succeed as adults, we've got to give them opportunities to succeed as kids, where failure is not catastrophic, where it's safe to fail and the consequences are relatively minor, where failure doesn't lead to losing a job or a foreclosure on the home or flunking out of college. Some people today think that the best thing for kids is to make life easy, but all that does is keep them from growing. There's a book that came out some years ago called The Coddling of the American Mind. I really enjoyed that book because in this book, the authors explain that the human being's psyche is not fragile. It can't be easily broken, nor is it rigid and can't be changed. Rather, they say it's somewheres in between. It's anti-fragile. In other words, the more it's challenged, the stronger it will get, much like an immune system. Why is it that today in 2019, the peanut allergy is rampant, and yet I don't remember that as a kid? It's so bad that we sent a snack with our daughter to kindergarten the other day. It was a jelly sandwich, and it came home because the teacher thought maybe possibly it had peanut butter somewhere. That's how strict it is. And it isn't for nothing. Peanut allergies are real, and people can die from exposure. But why is it so serious now, and it wasn't before? Well, in the book, they explain that in the peanut is something the body recognizes as a threat because it does exist elsewhere in nature. And when we're exposed to peanuts as small children, the body recognizes this as a false alarm. But if that never happens, that recognition doesn't occur and the body just goes berserk. And so nowadays, when kids are allergic to peanuts, or adults for that matter, the remedy is not to remove them all. The doctors will actually introduce it slowly in very controlled ways into the body so that immunity can develop. Just like that, kids need to be challenged. In Proverbs 23, it says, "Do not withhold discipline from a child. You will not kill him. He will not die." It says, "You'll save his soul." Because you will create in that child an attitude of obedience they will carry with them in life, and they will do much better. It will go well. They will live long in the land. So we need harmony. We need obedience in the home. Third, we need to model the right behavior. Notice it says in verse 4, "Fathers, do not provoke your children to anger." Now, this isn't directed just at fathers. This is just a singular way of referring to both parents. So, parents, do not provoke your children to anger. In 1976, Christianity Today put out an article where they surveyed 100 kids to find out the three most common things their father did say. Number 3 was keep quiet. Number 2 was we don't have enough money for that. And number 1 was I'm too tired, ask me later. The top 3 things from the kids' mouths that they heard from their dad. You ever notice how some parents are like that? They're just chronically negative. Everything is no. Everything is not now. Everything is ask me later. Everything is that's not right. That's not good enough. And it's an easy trap to fall into because you are tired and money is tight. And right now might not be a good time. I used to work for a guy like that. He was the chief of the police department I was at. And he was the type of man that was never happy with anything at all in life. I think he was a miserable person. We would turn in reports at the end of our shift that documented everything we had done on patrol, all the traffic stops we initiated, any arrests we had made, and so on and so forth. And we would turn this report in, and he would get it, and he would almost always give it back to you and say, "You need to correct that, you need to correct that." And it would be filled with red pen marks, like a teacher's report. And you'd get it back, and you'd grumble, you'd make the changes, and then you'd give it back to him. Wouldn't you know that same report would be back in your box the following day, telling you to change back all the stuff you just changed? That's how it went, all the time. And there are some parents who act like that. They set impossible standards. They're never pleased, never satisfied, always disappointed. Maybe they compare their children to one another. Why is it you can't be more like your brother or your sister or that kid across the road? You know, it was Albert Einstein who said everyone has talent, but if you judge a fish by its ability to climb a tree, it will go through life thinking it's stupid. Or maybe you've observed something that's come upon recently called a helicopter parent. To a parent who doesn't give their child any room, any privacy, any freedom. Mom and dad are always there hovering, changing things, running life, micromanaging. These things don't help. They just provoke anger, Paul talks about here. Or literally in the Greek, they cultivate a deep-seated resentment in the relationship toward, in this case, the parents. You know another thing that provokes anger? Not setting a positive example. When kids see that the rules are different, when the parents say one thing and they do another, when the parent yells at the child to keep quiet. I heard a comedian talk about one time how when he was little and he would get into a fight with his brother and he would hit his brother, his dad would hit him and say, "Hey, we don't hit." He said he was conflicted his whole life. He never understood. He was always confused. It leads to resentment. It happened in Paul's day. Everybody resented the religious leaders because they did live by different rules. The Pharisees did behave differently than they expected everyone else. The Pharisees did always tell everyone what they were doing wrong. And because of that, no one liked them. No one respected them. Not many people followed them except under threat. Jesus even says in Matthew 23, they preach, but they don't practice. Paul says, don't do that stuff. Not with your kids. Don't provoke them to anger, he says. But bring them up, verse 4, in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. In other words, it's got to be balanced. You've got to have both. You've got to have rebuke and you've got to have correction, but you also have to have instruction and encouragement. Proverbs chapter 9 says, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom." It's not in and of itself all that there is. "I didn't like what you did, but I'll tell you what, if you did it this way next time, it would go much better." It's got to be balanced. Another Harvard study this time showed the four greatest indicators of success in adulthood when found in a child's life are these: father's firm, fair, and consistent instruction, a mother's companionship and encouragement, having married parents that love one another, and four, regular family activities. Proverbs chapter 22 says to train up a child in the way they should go, and when they're old, they won't depart from it. Notice how Paul says here in verse 1, children, obey your parents. Verse 2, honor your father and mother. Well, without the discipline, there isn't the obedience. Without the instruction, there isn't the honor. It takes both to properly raise a child. And so he says, bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. And the way we do that is by setting the example, by not provoking to anger, by letting the kids see the expectation and then modeling the behavior. It's estimated that 83% of everything a child learns comes from their parents. It doesn't come from the school. It doesn't come from TV. It doesn't come from music or anything else. It comes from watching their parents at home. So faithfulness includes harmony, obedience, modeling right behavior. And finally, as we close, we have to talk about employment. And here's why. Because your faithful life at home will extend into your workplace. You're not going to be one way at home and another way at the workplace, at least not for long. Notice it says in verse 5, bondservants, obey your earthly masters with fear and trembling, with a sincere heart as you would Christ, not by the way of eye service as people pleasers, but as bondservants of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart, rendering service with a good will as to the Lord and not to man, knowing that whatever anyone does, this he will receive back from the Lord, whether he is a bondservant or free. Masters, verse 9. Do the same to them and stop your threatening, knowing that he who is both their master and yours is in heaven and that there is no partiality with him. You know, there will be times in every job where you're not happy. Every job has a Monday. Every job has a Wednesday. Every job has a boss we don't like. There will be times where you don't like what management did. Maybe you were passed over on that promotion and you know you deserved it, but it went to the boss's bratty kid and you can see what happened. Maybe they changed your work assignment and what you're doing isn't what you signed up for, but things have gone a different direction. Maybe they changed your schedule and the hours you're working aren't the ones you would prefer. Maybe you've got to wear an ugly uniform that you wouldn't put on a convict. That could be life. And yet the Bible says in spite of that, faithfulness dictates if we are there, verse 7, that we render service with a good will as to the Lord and not to men. You know, Paul said the same thing in 1 Corinthians 10, do all things as if unto the Lord. My father-in-law worked for a food processing plant for 37 years. Almost four decades, he went into the same building, the same set of doors. He did many different jobs in that building in 37 years. It was a plant that made a number of brand name foods. And so sometimes he would drive a forklift. Sometimes he would sweep the floor. Sometimes he would be on the line putting labels on one thing and labels on another. Oh, and by the way, if you are wondering if all of the ketchup really does come from one plant, it does, because he did it. He also told me that his favorite job was shoveling bean sprouts. The bean sprout room, hundreds of thousands of pounds of bean sprouts. He would take a snow shovel and literally shovel these things. And I don't know where they shoveled them to, but that's what he did. For 37 years, he worked first shift, second shift, third shift, night shift, weekend shift, overtime shift. He didn't always like what he was doing, but he said he never looked at it that way. He always looked at it as a way he was serving God. You know, Daniel had the same attitude when he was taken hostage by the Babylonian king. Nobody would have blamed Daniel if he had said, "This isn't my king, this isn't my land. I don't want to be here. I'm not giving my best. I was taken against my will. This isn't my home. These aren't my people. This isn't my religion. They don't worship my God. You're not going to make me cooperate." Nobody would have blamed Daniel had he had that attitude. And yet he didn't. His attitude was, "I'm going to serve the Lord. I'm going to do my best." And he did. And he's remembered for just that very thing. To the contrary, I remember working with a man who told me one time he would not sweep the floors because it wasn't his job. He did not last very long. The Bible says in verse 7, to render service with a good will as to the Lord and not to man. To do our best. And here's why it's so important. It's for the same reason it's important at home. Because when people look at you, they will see what you think of Jesus. And they'll think the same thing. Just like kids look at you at the home, people will look at you at work. And whatever they see coming through your life, they'll say, "That's what it must mean to be a Christian. This guy's no better than anyone else. Look at her, she always shows up late." Or rather, will they see, "Wow, they do their best. We can count on that person. They're always early. They always meet deadlines. They always do everything they can to help." And so Paul says, render service with a good will as to the Lord and not to man. I mentioned at the very beginning of the message that there is a crisis in the American family. I believe that's true. Relationships everywhere are falling apart. Parents everywhere are absent. Teenage pregnancy abounds. And with it often comes abortion. Drug use is prevalent. Welfare dependence is real. And people wonder, why is it that we have more people in jail in America than any other developed nation on earth? That's a fact. Why is gun violence so high? Just the other day, there was just another school shooting in California that killed several people. Why is drug use so high? Why do half of all marriages end in divorce, whether in the church or in the world? Why are we so politically divided that little ever seems to get done anymore? Well, I'll tell you why. The answer is not more taxes. The answer is not more money. The answer isn't new laws. This is not a federal problem. This is a family problem. It's a faith problem. And so we need a faithful home.